use that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Judd Lonis, registration number 33208, on behalf of Mr. McMorris. The issue in this case is whether it's permissible for the prosecution to put its star witness, Barbara Rodriguez, on a plane to Miami before disclosing exculpatory Brady material that was in its possession and control before she departed. The answer is that it is not. The prosecution's late disclosure in this case prejudiced Mr. McMorris and represents a threat to the integrity of the criminal justice system. At issue are two pieces of evidence. The first is a statement made by Barbara Rodriguez to the prosecution's paralegal before she even testified in the case, admitting that her husband possessed the gun during the affray. The second is a 16-page report detailing Mrs. Rodriguez's inconsistent pretrial statements to Officer Daniel Moore, the prosecution's advisory witness in this case. The state admits that both pieces of evidence are Brady material. The state admits that both pieces of evidence should have been disclosed pursuant to Rule of Criminal Procedure 16. The state argues, essentially, that despite these violations, there was no prejudice to Mr. McMorris. But the prejudice to Mr. McMorris was fairly complete. Barbara Rodriguez was the most important prosecution witness in this case. The exhibit I've given you is the Attorney General's statement of facts from their answer. And what I've done is I've highlighted every place where they have quoted Ms. Rodriguez's testimony. Her testimony was critical to explain the prosecution's version of the case, not only in the trial court, but it continues to be on appeal. Indeed, the prosecution's case, whole case falls apart without her testimony. And that's what that exhibit is designed to show.
But didn't the prosecutor himself or herself actually impeach this witness and told the jury that at least in certain respects she was not believable?
Yes, but Your Honor, during his closing argument, it said she told a consistent version of what happened. It was all consistent, and it asked the jury to rely on her version of events in order to convict Mr. McMorris. It was able to do that because Mr. McMorris was denied the right to cross-examine and confront Ms. Rodriguez with her inconsistent statements. That was the opportunity he lost. In the Colorado Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and Professor Wigmore, as quoted in my brief, have all consistently stated that delayed impeachment is not an adequate substitute for the constitutional right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against them. In People v. Terry, the Supreme Court noted that the credibility of a witness, when the utmost important to the people's case, that anything that would weaken the witness's testimony would necessarily strengthen the defense. And these statements showed that Ms. Rodriguez concealed evidence in the case. Not only she concealed evidence, but actually she took the witness stand, took an oath, and repeatedly lied to the jury about the important facts of this case. And the defendant was denied the opportunity to confront her with her lies while she was on the witness stand, to have the jury observe her demeanor while lying and compare that demeanor to the remainder of her testimony.
Mr. Lonis, I know that your opposing counsel argues that there's no prejudice because the paralegal came on and was able to impeach the key witness, and that was actually beneficial because then there wasn't the opportunity for the key witness to perhaps deny making that statement.
Yes, Your Honor, and respectfully, I think that misses the whole point. The whole point was to have her lie on the witness stand, have the jury see her lie, and then later be subject to impeachment. Or, alternatively, as Professor Wigmore states in his famous treatise on evidence, the witness supplies her own refutation. Therefore, it's immediate. It immediately follows her direct examination, and it's much more powerful to have the witness admit she lies on the stand or to lie again when supplied with a reputation and then have the defense have an opportunity to call a prosecuting paralegal to show that she lied or the detective in the case to show that she lied. That is a very powerful right. And the right to cross-examination, something that's vital to that, is the opportunity for the jury to observe that when he's testifying on the stand.
If we agree with your argument that there was a constitutional violation regarding the use of post-Miranda silence, do we even need to address the issue you're talking about now?
Your Honor, you would not, because then the case would be remanded for a new trial, and Mr. McMorris would, of course, be in possession of all this exculpatory material.
I guess what I'm suggesting is, before your time is up, I would really like to hear your argument regarding the use of the post-Miranda silence.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate you asking that question. Your Honor, really, analogy is still the best form of legal reasoning. And if you look at the cases I cited in my brief, chiefly the opinions of this court in Ortega and then the Supreme Court in Ortega, the case is really closely analogous to those cases, where the Supreme Court was presented with a similar situation where post-Miranda silence was used against the defendant at trial to prove his guilt. And not only that, it was plain error. You know, if it was plain error way back when, before this court, and the College Supreme Court had issued the Ortega opinion, it's plainly plain error now, because everyone's on notice that this evidence is not admissible.
Does the Supreme Court's decision in Anderson versus Charles change in any respect the plain error calculus?
Your Honor, the plain error, I'm not totally familiar with that case, Your Honor, but I know that the issues are our first error recognition. That was the point I just addressed, is the obviousness of the error. It's also, you also have to look at the prejudice to the defense. When you consider the prejudice to the defense, under plain error, you have to consider the nature of the right that's being violated. And in Ortega, the court looked at the nature of the right being violated. It was the right to remain silent, to not be a witness against oneself, and identify that as a really, really important right. And likewise, when this court does a plain error analysis, if that's the way it goes, I've argued that under Chapman, this is still a constitutional harmless error must apply. But if it goes with the plain error approach, it has to recognize, as in Ortega, that this is a violation of a very, very serious constitutional right, and therefore, the prejudice to the defense is manifest. One thing that distinguishes this case from Ortega is that not only is post-Miranda silence, in Ortega, the defendant's post-Miranda silence was used against him. Here, the defendant's silence throughout the criminal proceedings was used against him in an unfair way. First, he exercised his right to remain silent after a motion was busted. Second, the court gave him his Rule 5 adjustment 2 days later, informed him that he had a constitutional right to remain silent. He did not make any statements against himself or any statements whatsoever.
Do you argue that there's a separate basis for reversal because the prosecutor's statement that the first time self-defense was ever raised was when the defendant, the words were sprung self-defense for the first time in trial? Is that part of your argument regarding the comment upon the silence, or is that a separate argument?
Your Honor, I argue that that was prosecutorial misconduct and identified itself as such in my brief. However, I argue that that is part of the prejudice, the reason the extreme prejudice exists, and I put it under the heading of the constitutional violation. I did not make a separate argument. I think the court certainly can and must consider the prosecutor's arguments and the unfairness of those arguments when it decides whether reversible error occurred in the case.
Mr. Lewis, I noticed you obviously relying on Ortega. Do you read Ortega as saying that the defendant testified at trial or did not testify at trial?
He did not testify at trial.
So you read Ortega as saying he did not?
That's right. Your Honor, in fact, that's interesting because if the defendant testifies at trial, he has then waived his right to remain silent, and in some instances he may be impeached with his silence, pretrial silence. When he doesn't testify at trial, when he maintains the right to remain silent, especially after receiving a Curtis advisement, that that's when his right to remain silent is being punished. And I, Judge Berger, the prosecutor's comment, it was quite duplicitous after they had received a Rule 16 endorsement 8 months before trial, explaining that our defense was self-defense. And in fact, even mentioning it during the opening statement, and then to then say, ask a witness, the advisor that was in the case, who was intimately familiar with this case, have you ever heard about self-defense today? And allowing that witness to answer no. And then an argument saying, we never heard about self-defense until today. When they knew for 8 months that self-defense was Mr. Morris's defense. Completely unfair. Unless your honors have any questions, I'll reserve my time for the vote.
You may.
Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Chase Fisher. I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. Regarding the discovery involving Barbara Rodriguez, there was no abuse of discretion by the trial court in how it handled that particular issue when it arose at trial. The trial court was in the best position to evaluate the issue of discovery in that matter, and is also in the best position to determine what effect it would have on the trial. The defendant's argument regarding these two particular pieces of discovery fails because it cannot show prejudice regarding these particular pieces of discovery. There were two tests that were mentioned by the parties in their briefs to this court. One was Strickler by the defendant, the people cited to Daly. Prejudice is a major component of both of those tests. The reason why the defendant cannot show prejudice is that according to the case cited by the people, People versus Brown, and also the string cites mentioned in that case, the defendant has to request a continuance, and failing to request a continuance, he cannot subsequently claim surprise or prejudice. That did not happen in this particular case. Looking at the evidence specifically, you cannot conclude that the trial court erred in either of those particular issues regarding Barbara Rodriguez, either her statement to the paralegal or the report.
Mr. Fisher?
Yes. Well,
of what value would a continuance have been? I'm sort of confused about why that would have mattered here.
The continuance is important because that is a far lesser sanction that the trial court could impose in this matter versus actually seeking a mistrial.
But how would it have been a sanction? Would it have prejudiced the prosecution to have a continuance or something? How would it have addressed the problem at all to continue the trial unless they were going to bring back Ms. Rodriguez from Florida or wherever she went?
Which could have been a possibility in this case. We just don't know.
Did anyone suggest that possibility, either the prosecution or the defense?
No, but no one suggested bringing back Ms. Rodriguez, but again, that particular possible sanction was not explored either, whether it was feasible or not. Again, going back to the evidence in particular, the trial court determined that it was going to put on the paralegal and allow the prosecution to expose the inconsistency in Ms. Rodriguez's statements. And that's in fact exactly what occurred here. They were able to show that in fact she made a contradictory statement that was exposed to the jury and it did not go contradicted in any way, shape, or form.
Well, Mr. Fisher, I believe that your opposing counsel is arguing that the error was the opportunity to have Ms. Rodriguez on the stand at that moment being cross-examined, and that the delay in any ability to contradict her previous statement is the error.
That would be true, except for we're basically guessing what she would have testified to had she been put on the stand. In other words, we're kind of presuming that something may have happened, but what in actuality happened, which is the whole essence of prejudice, what is the final result is she was in fact an impeached witness in this particular case.
Well, my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is if cross-examination is limited, that we as a reviewing court are to presume the maximum potential of the cross-examination?
I believe that's correct,
okay.
Yes. But again, we have to look at what the end result was here, what the actual prejudice, or what was the end result here of determining, you know, this Ms. Rodriguez testimony. And if you look at, in fact, what happened here in the end, the prosecution had to make a number of concessions in its closing argument to the jury. In fact, citing specifically, they had to admit, at least in rebuttal closing argument, that she said, and I'm quoting here, stuff the jury might not believe. She also did not testify truthfully about her husband having a gun to protect him. They also admitted that she concealed information from the police. And they also had to concede, and this is probably the biggest one of all, that just because she lied on some stuff doesn't mean that she lied on everything. So really the end result here is that Ms. Rodriguez, in fact, was an impeached witness, and that was carried forward to the end of the trial. That is what the sanction was imposed by the trial court, and that's what was carried forward into jury deliberations in this particular matter.
But Mr. Fisher, do you think that there might have been additional value added to the defendant if Ms. Rodriguez had admitted that she lied on the stand under cross-examination?
Well, again, we're kind of presuming here that she would admit that she lied. There's also an equally valid assumption that maybe she might have been able to explain away the inconsistency. We don't know. We're sort of guessing as to how she might have testified. And again, I carry it back to what actually happened here. What was the final result regarding her testimony?
Okay, thank you.
And if the court has no further questions regarding this particular matter, we'd ask that you affirm the convictions below.
What about the use of the silence?
Now, regarding the use of the silence, first of all, there's been an issue regarding the scope of review that should be applied to this issue. I know that the defendant has claimed that harmless error should apply to this. The people have maintained that it's plain error. And in fact, it's still the people's position that it's plain error that should apply. Besides the case sites that were mentioned in the brief, we'd also call the court's attention to the cases of People versus Apodaca Zambori, reported at 2013 COA 29, and People versus Hare, 868 P. 2nd, 1121. And applying plain error to those specific issues, you can't conclude, in fact, that any plain error occurred with the way the prosecution shaped its questions or that prosecutorial misconduct happened in the closing argument.
Well, before we get to plain error, though, was there error? Was there constitutional error?
We would say that no, there wasn't any particular error in the way the questions were shaped. And again, looking at it, the first part of the question was permissible, where the prosecutor asked the defendant, did the defendant say anything about self-defense during the interview? And again, there was no question. In fact, he was Mirandizing, he was talking voluntarily with the police. The second part of the question, which says, did he say anything at all, has to be compared to the testimony on the previous page, which said that the defendant ended the interview voluntarily. So at all.
But Mr. Fisher, I guess I'm stuck with your first point, that the first question was proper. I mean, obviously the prosecutor knew that the defendant did not mention self-defense in the interview.
Right.
So he knew the answer to the question. So isn't asking the question simply to highlight what the defendant did not say post-Miranda advisement?
Not necessarily. Again, it depends on how you interpret where the question was focusing its attention.
Well, he knew the answer was going to be no. The defendant didn't say it. So he was asking the question in order to let the jury know that the defendant didn't say anything about self-defense.
But it also highlights, in fact, what the investigator knew, which is, I think, the more important aspect of this whole question, because it was, in fact, the lead investigator. It was the guy who was looking at all the evidence in this particular case. So it's what he knew, not necessarily an inference of guilt aimed at the defendant. And based upon that, it was a proper question because it was aiming as to what the chief investigator, the guy who interviewed all the witnesses, knew in this particular case.
Well, on that issue about whether it was proper, the defendant relies heavily on the Ortega decision that we discussed earlier.
That's correct.
I don't think you mentioned Ortega once in your answer brief, which sort of concerned me because I want to know why this is different from Ortega.
Because the error in Ortega was flagrant. That's the most important issue here. In Ortega, you had argument where they were talking specifically about the defendant's arrest, the reading of his rights, and specific silence when he was, in fact, in police custody. That did not happen in this case. Again, it's the people's position that you're looking at this from a plain error standard. And the fact that you're missing all these particular elements regarding the prosecutor's closing argument, and in fact, Ortega only applies to closing argument, at least for people's read of it.
Wasn't the first problematic statement Ortega in the opening statement?
Yes, it was. But in fact, again, you have to consider this within the scope that it was argument.
Wasn't the prosecutor's statement to the jury that the first time that the defendant had ever raised self-defense was at the trial itself, wasn't that flagrantly false?
It wasn't flagrantly false when you consider that the prosecution can use evidence for all reasonable inferences. And again, I go back to the actual question that was posed to Investigator Mork in this case, which is his statement that the first time he learned about self-defense was he was sitting at trial. And the fact that it was unobjected, it became evidence, and the prosecution could use that as a reasonable inference based upon the evidence.
Why does it matter when the investigator first heard self-defense?
Because he's the chief investigator. He's the head investigator. He's the guy who's looking into all the facts of the case. He's the main person who's gathering all the evidence and all the discovery in this matter and looking at the case from all angles. So, in fact, he's a very important witness.
But the prosecutor knew that whatever inference would be drawn from the investigator saying, I never heard of that self-defense before, whatever inference was drawn from that was flagrantly false. Isn't that true?
I can't say it's flagrantly false because, again, there's plenty of case law that says that knowledge that the police obtain is imputed to the prosecution. I don't know if you can go the reverse and say knowledge from the prosecution is inferred to the police as well. In fact, I did a research on that, and I was only able to find one case at all that said that, a New York case. But in fact, at least in Colorado, that's not the state of the law.
Well, let me ask you this. So we're looking at what the questioning by the prosecutor was, but then we also need to look at how did the prosecutor use that evidence. And so during its rebuttal closing, it was not necessarily using the evidence to talk about what the investigator knew. It was using the evidence to tell the jury, it's like, isn't it interesting, the first time that Mr. McMorris mentions his acting in self-defense was when the attorney got up at opening statement. And why is that? The reason is because it's not true. It's not how things went down. So what is your response to how the prosecutor used it, and why is this different from Ortega?
Again, looking at it from plain error, it goes back to the knowledge that, in fact, the chief investigator, who is the person who is helping to shape the prosecution's case, knows. Again, that person is the head person looking at all the facts of this particular case. He's the person who's trying to figure out if the fact the crime occurred, and he has no knowledge of self-defense. Again, it's a reasonable inference based upon Officer Mork's testimony. The second reason is also that, at least in Ortega, the prosecution is allowed to rebut any kind of argument that the defendant made in closing. That was an important factor in Ortega. And here, the defendant's closing argument, in fact, was pretty much all about self-defense. There were a few limited instances where he's attacking, of course, the state's witnesses, calling them liars, but in fact, the entire closing argument was about self-defense. So once they open the door in closing, the prosecution is allowed to rebut what he raises in closing.
But what did they open the door to? I'm not understanding that. What precisely? I mean, I think it's too broad to just say, well, self-defense. What specifically was the door open to that would allow the prosecutor to make a statement that seems to me to be just plain false, that the first time self-defense ever came up was at the trial?
It goes to, in fact, what Officer Morton knew from the time of the crime up until trial. As I mentioned before, he's the lead person. He's the person gathering all the facts. And he knew nothing about self-defense until he came to the trial itself.
And the prosecutor in closing wasn't mentioning what Officer Morton knew. He was just talking about what the defendant didn't say at all before trial. He didn't confine it to what the investigator knew.
That would be true, except for the fact that, again, it's the police are the ones that are looking into this and assessing what happened and how the facts went down and how these particular issues developed. And again, nothing was mentioned for self-defense to them. They interviewed approximately 40 witnesses. Nothing was mentioned about self-defense from any of those individuals. There was just nothing in the record to substantiate self-defense in this particular case.
Well, of course it would be relevant if other witnesses either mentioned self-defense or gave evidence supporting self-defense or not, but that's not what the prosecutor said. He's talking about what Mr. McMullis said and did not say. He wasn't limited to other witnesses. He was talking about Mr. McMullis. He says, isn't it interesting, the first time, and he was interviewed twice, he was talking about the interview with the defendant, the first time he mentions it was when his attorney got up and said it in opening statement. He's talking about what Mr. McMullis said and did not say, not what other witnesses did and did not say.
And I agree, looking at the plain wording of that. My fallback position, if even this court was to determine that was erroneous, is in fact that it was harmless error. And the reason it was harmless error is based upon the incredibly weak self-defense claim that was put forward by the defendant in this case. There was no testimony from any witness, from either on direct or cross, that would substantiate the self-defense claim. The state in this case said that there was a scintilla of evidence to support giving the self-defense charge to the jury, and that's pretty much all there was in this case, was a scintilla of evidence. So we would at least claim that the error itself was harmless.
Didn't the prosecutor essentially concede that the victim had a gun? And that Rodriguez was lying when she said he didn't?
Yes, that in fact is the way that...
So I don't understand when you say there's no evidence, not even no evidence of self-defense. Doesn't the fact that the victim had a gun at least provide some evidence of self-defense?
Again, it depends on how reasonable the defendant was reacting to the situation. Ms. Rodriguez may have known that her husband was armed. It doesn't necessarily translate to the fact that, in fact, the defendant knew he was armed. There was that concession made on Ms. Rodriguez's knowledge, but doesn't translate, in fact, to the defendant's knowledge.
Okay, thank you, counsel, for your argument.
Thank you. Up.
Mr. Lonas, you have a little over 4 minutes and 20 seconds. We might give you a few extra seconds if you need to.
Okay, thank you. Your Honors, Officer Mark was the advisory witness in the case. He sat at the prosecution table during the entire proceedings as far as the record shows. The prosecutor's asking if he's ever heard of self-defense. The obvious implication is that it hasn't been mentioned until trial. I was going to point out the closing argument, but at least two of you have already done so. The Attorney General states that there was no evidence of self-defense in this case, but in fact, Mr. Morris was shot 2 times. His car had 6 shots in it from, I believe, a .44 caliber handgun. Quentin Finkley admitted that he was charged with attempted murder with Mr. Morris and the victim on the basis that he shot first until he changed his story and told Officer Mark a different story. There is strong evidence of self-defense in this case. It certainly created a jury issue. Unless the court has any other questions about Ortega, I have a few comments on the first issue I raised. And one of the questions, I believe it was Judge Navarro asked, was did anyone suggest that Ms. Rodriguez be called back? In fact, the court did upon learning of this violation. The district attorney went to the court and said that we have this exculpatory information. And the court said, all right, so you intend to recall her to clear that up. To which the prosecutor replied, not Ms. Rodriguez, because she's on a plane back to Florida. I don't see a continuance. I mean, she is...
Did the defense request that she be recalled?
It was... I don't think he did. He moved for a mistrial. But he clearly stated that impeaching her through another witness is not okay because he would lose his right to confront her. And in their briefs, the Attorney General has recognized that we have preserved this issue for appeal. So unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you.
We ask for reverse and remand for a new trial.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Lonas. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. And we'll allow